In 1838, 10 years before he founded the Oneida community, John Humphrey Noyes sent a letter containing a proposal of marriage to a woman named Harriet Holton. And it was a doozy. Though the two had only met on a couple of occasions, Harriet Holton was an avid reader of Noyes's many theological writings and was fully supportive of his attempts to spread the gospel of an extremely controversial variety of Christian perfectionism. But there was, as Noyes acknowledged frankly, no spark between them. As Noyes put it later, there was no particular love of the sentimental kind between us. And as he told Harriet Holton in remarkably blunt terms, the things he admired about her were decidedly not romantic. As he put it, "In the plain speech of a witness and not a flatterer, I respect and love you for many desirable qualities, spiritual, moral, personal, especially your faith, kindness, simplicity, and modesty." However sincere John Humphrey Noyes was in his assessment of Harriet Holton's good personal qualities, he was also keenly aware of her wealth. Indeed, his proposal followed hard on the heels of Harriet Holton's $80 contribution, a significant sum in 1838, right as Noyes was at his most desperate. It was not that John Humphrey Noyes was unmoved by sexual or romantic feelings. Far from it, as we'll explore in a future episode. In fact, at various times in his life, he became positively obsessed with women. Indeed, in his extraordinary letter to Harriet Holton, Noyes laid out the highly unconventional terms of his proposal that would allow him to act on those feelings for other women if the opportunity should arise. After a deliberation of more than a year in patient watching for indications of the Lord's will, he wrote, "I am now permitted, and indeed happily constrained, to propose to you a partnership which I will not call marriage till I have defined it. As believers, we are already one with each other and with all saints. Therefore," he went on, "we can enter into no engagements with each other which shall limit the range of our affections as they are limited in matrimony by the fashions of this world." What Noyes was saying in highfaluting, almost legalistic language, was that he had no intention of their union being monogamous. I'm Dan Greenstone, and this is the American Utopia Podcast. The Oneida community was based on a radical reimagining of marriage that the community's founder, John Humphrey Noyes, called complex marriage. And to understand what he was trying to achieve, we first need to take a look at the state of marriage in the first half of the 19th century.
Marriage is what brings us together today. Marriage, that dream within a dream.
Stand your ground,
men. Stand your ground. Then love, true love, will follow you forever.
So treasure your wife.
Skip to the end.
Have you the wing?
That, of course, is the famous wedding scene from the movie The Princess Bride. And the way the minister links true love and marriage seems so obvious to us, so normal, that it may come as a surprise to learn that it wasn't always so. Indeed, placing romantic love at the center of marriage is, relatively speaking, a new idea in human history. Historian Stephanie Kuntz documented this change in her seminal book, Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. I spoke to her about this transformation in marriage and how it influenced John Humphrey Noyes and the Oneida community. And actually, we touched on a whole bunch of related topics, including the idea that marital love can be selfish, the origins of the graham cracker, and the invention of the vibrator. I swear, they're related. Professor Kuntz is a fascinating person, and I really enjoyed my conversation with her. Oh, and just a quick warning, while there's no swearing, we did discuss some fairly adult topics in explicit fashion.
I'm Stephanie Kuntz. I teach history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And I've written several books on these topics, but probably the most relevant is Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage.
Great. And thanks for helping us try to put Oneida in the context of its time. So, Stephanie, you write in your book that for most of human history, marriage was not fundamentally about love. And I'm wondering if you can explain, if it wasn't about love, what was it?
Well, ironically, given how much we think that marriage is a private relationship between two individuals, and one of the most commonly cited problems is interfering in-laws, for thousands of years, marriage was more about getting in-laws, getting connected to other families, than it was about uniting two individuals. In the earliest band-level societies, it was a way of turning strangers into friends and allies or trading partners. Many ancient languages, the word for wife is peace weaver. As societies got more complex and complicated, it was a way of attracting very, very advantageous in-laws. You know, in a period before banks and capital, when you depended upon your personal networks, if you were in the upper echelons of society, you wanted to marry off your son or daughter to somebody in the upper echelons or even a little slightly above it. For the middle classes, it was long one of the main ways of raising income and forming businesses. And even in the lower classes, the peasants wanted to marry somebody who had a good reputation as a worker, maybe adjoining land or complementary land in a different section of the village or connections at court. So for thousands of years, marriage was about making connections with other families, and the individual wishes of the children were put below that. In fact, in many cases, they were not allowed to marry who they loved. But even when they were old enough, their parents were gone, the social system was such that people understood that marriage was far too important a political and work institution. You don't join a job just because you're attracted to one of the other workers. And that was their idea, that love was, well, it was great if it would develop after marriage. Some young people thought, oh boy, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to marry for love? But it's no accident that most love stories ended in tragedies in the past.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So if that's true, when did marriage based on romantic love start to become the norm?
You get the stirrings of it as you get more independence, the development of wage labor, so that a man no longer had to wait to his parents to pass over the farm or business. A woman no longer had to wait for the parents to provide her a dowry, which meant that some daring couples could actually defy their parents and marry for love. Perhaps even more important, the market revolution and the ideas of the Enlightenment all began to develop this new ideology that the older generation and the state should not dictate to youth. It helped, of course, that we were also developing financial institutions and banks and other ways of raising capital. So as this happened, the ideal of love began to get more and more popular, especially in England and America. The French referred to it a little snippily as the a British idea of marriage by fascination, you know, as opposed to marriage by convenience and practicality. But there was a protracted period in the 17th and 18th century where these things were debated. I think in America itself, the American Revolution begins to be the real turning point.
Perhaps no observer captured this transitional moment in marriage better than Jane Austen did. Here's a scene of one of the film productions of Pride and Prejudice, where Lizzie and Charlotte Lucas discuss Charlotte's engagement to the odious William Collins.
Charlotte!
My dear Lizzie, I've come here to tell you the news. Mr. Collins and I are engaged.
Engaged?
Yes.
To be married?
Yes, of course, Lizzie. What other kind of engaged is there? Oh, for heaven's sake, Lizzie, don't look at me like that. There is no earthly reason why I shouldn't be as happy with him as any other.
But he's ridiculous.
Oh, hush. Not all of us can afford to be romantic. I've been offered a comfortable home and protection. There's a lot to be thankful for.
Charlotte.
I'm 27 years old. I've no money and no prospects. I'm already a burden to my parents. And I'm frightened. So don't judge me, Lizzie. Don't you dare judge me.
That was Keira Knightley playing Lizzie and Claudie Blakely as Charlotte Lucas from the 2005 film version of Jane Austen's book. The transition from the old-fashioned, more instrumental and transactional version of marriage, embodied by Charlotte Lucas, to the modern love-based marriage, represented by Lizzie, was controversial and polarizing. So I asked Stephanie Kuntz to explain why.
I think there were two kinds of criticisms that were emerging. On the conservative side, defenders of what was then traditional marriage, the marriage of political and economic convenience, were absolutely horrified by the radical implications of marrying for love. Because how will I get my son to marry the person that my family needs him to marry if he can say, ew, I don't love her? How will we get people to marry at all if they haven't found someone they love? How will we prevent divorce? If marriage is about love, people will demand the right to leave a marriage. And so social conservatives were terrified by the idea.
To take that, I guess some of the social critics, I want to talk about them for a minute. The social critics on the left. So there were a lot of criticisms of the what we now think of as the traditional 19th century marriage as being oppressive to women and coercive. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, what were the problems in marriage at that time for women from a leftist or a feminist point of view?
Well, for hundreds of, if not thousands of years, marriage had not just been a way of allying families and a way of searching for improving your political and economic lot between families, a center of intrigue and leverage. But it was also a way of holding women in their place. And in the Anglo-American tradition, for example, remember the nice old marriage vow that a man says upon marriage, with all my worldly goods, I thee endow. Actually, it went the opposite way. When a woman married, she became completely covered. A femme couverte was the word for it. In the identity of her husband, she could make no decisions independently of him. Her body and her sexuality was his. This is why right up until the 1970s, states did not have laws against marital rape. That was part of the services a wife owed to her husband. And certainly in the 19th century, you still had the notion that the man owned the property. Everything a woman brought with her at marriage, including her personal jewels, anything she earned within it. It wasn't until 1897 that a British court, for example, held that a man could not imprison another British citizen, even if she was his wife.
That's amazing. So John Humphrey Noyes, the founder of Oneida, was, it was a lot of things, but one of them was he was sort of a critic of the oppressiveness of traditional marriage. And he was a sort of fanatical newspaper publisher and pamphlet writer. And he talked about this all the time, and maybe we'll get to it in a minute about how he saw Oneida acting differently. But, among other things, he compared 19th century marriage to the institution of slavery. And I'm wondering if you think that the comparison is at all warranted or if it's hyperbole.
Well, there's, of course, hyperbole in it. You didn't get, wives working in the field with being whipped by lashes. But the comparison is not completely inaccurate in the sense that once a woman entered marriage, now, unlike slavery, it tended to be at least semi-voluntary. You could stay a spinster if you liked, although it would be very hard to support yourself. Women did have options, especially middle-class women, that that Africans brought to this country did not have. Nevertheless, once you entered it, a woman was subject to the control of her husband. It was very difficult for her to get out. It was much more easy for a man to get out and repudiate his wife than for a woman to get out of it. She could be beaten. Now, there was an 1869, I believe it was, I might be 2 years off, a court decision in North Carolina that a man did not have the right to beat his wife. However, the court decision ended by saying the proper remedy is to close the curtains and let the man and wife work it out, which is basically an endorsement of, well, if he doesn't stop because we told him that it wasn't nice, then we're not going to stop him. So she was physically at his mercy. She was sexually at his mercy. She had no legal independence. And, you know, it's right up until the 1960s that women can't even take out credit cards in their own name. And it was much stronger than that back in the 1860s. Women, as I say, their property was owned by their husbands. You began to get some reforms for more affluent women because fathers did not want run off with any inheritance or dowry that they might give their daughters. And you began to get a few reforms that protected the inheritance of wives, but man still owned what she earned.
So I guess post-revolution, there develops this concept of separate spheres for men and women. And I'm wondering if you could just take a minute or two and explain that concept.
Well, that's an interesting concept because this is what we tend to think of as traditional gender roles, but it was actually a reworking of gender roles that had very complicated impact on women. You have to go back a little bit. In the medieval world and in colonial days, men were in charge for sure. It was patriarchs. Men were the boss of the husband, the wives were the employees. But there was no concept that they lived in different spheres or had different capabilities. Women didn't wait for men to bring home the bacon. They helped raise the pig. They cured the bacon. They're the ones often who took it to market. They were vital co-workers on the farm. And precisely because they were vital co-workers or employees, they were under a lot of control. So the idea was not that women have this own sphere that makes them incapable of doing the things that men do, but that, by golly, since they are women, they are under his control. There's a wonderful colonial sermon that says to wives, widely reprinted, "Yea, though thou may have greater faculties of mind than thy husband, have brought more estate with thee at marriage, and be of better parts, yet since he is thy husband, the Lord has set him above you." You may be smarter, you may be stronger, you may be richer, too bad. Okay, so now that we say that we believe in democracy and we believe in love, those kinds of things don't work. And also, as I say, it's a very disturbing thing because you're a little worried that this is going to upset the balance and make it possible, make family life much more unstable. So a new ideology developed, partly in response to the development of waged labor and the separation of paid work from home domestic work in which women were more involved, and partly in response to fears that this new marriage system would be very unstable. And the idea of love was reworked. Okay, we want you to marry for love. But love was then defined as the union of two people who were so opposite that neither could exist without each other. Men suddenly were stripped of the ability to be emotional. You know, 16th, 17th novels have men weeping tears all over the place. That disappears. Men are made the instrumental ones, the breadwinners, a concept unknown before that time. They're the practical ones. They're the competitive ones. They're the ruthless ones. Women, who used to be thought of as huge, great bargainers, shrewd, all of these sort of things, now they become the ones who take care of the emotion. They take care of the home. They're considered to be not unequal, but just too weak to do these other things. So instead of it being a patriarchal decision to keep them home, it's a protective decision to keep them home. So this doctrine of opposites, for some women, it represented a step forward from the time that they were just told, you know, you're a lesser man, you're not as good as a man. For others, of course, it represented, you know, a terribly ironic, disturbing thing. I'm supposed to be equal. I'm supposed to be loved. I'm supposed to love my husband, but I'm supposed to love my subordination and my weakness and my inequality.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I actually hadn't intended to ask you about this, but what you were saying reminded me of Sylvester Graham. Do you know his legacy as a sort of reformer? He's the graham cracker is named after him, but he would have hated the graham cracker.
So you'll have to tell me about it. I know the name, but not.
Yeah, he's really interesting. So he, I think he was raised not in your stereotypical 19th century home. I can't remember the details, but I think he might have been an orphan and he had a really rough childhood. And perhaps because of that, he came to idealize this sort of perfect separate spheres type family. And so he's sort of, you know, it's one of the perversities of history that he's associated with the graham cracker, because his actual thing was he hated store-bought bread, which was becoming, or, you know, professionally made bread. And it was, you know, he saw it as full of impurities and made by someone who didn't love the family. And so he was this great promoter of the hearth and, you know, returning all of the baking and all of that stuff to the home. And he also, interestingly, and I think this, there may be some connections actually with things you wrote about in your book, he was a huge anti-masturbation advocate. And so anyway, I guess that's sort of just the ethos and the zeitgeist, is there's these people sort of promoting this idealized vision of what the family should be.
Yes. Idealized and mythologized, because actually, if you look back to colonial days, women did not spend all their time, for example, taking care of children. They were so busy with productive work like curing bacon and going to market and working on the farm that childcare was turned over to slightly older siblings. But yes, this new ideology develops as the separation of spheres, as productive work moves out of the home. Women are told to focus on the production of love, which includes the home-baked goods, the care of the children, the preparation of elaborate meals, this sort of thing.
Interesting. Okay, so what was the impact of that new dynamic or that new model on relations between husbands and wives? And I'm curious both sort of emotionally, but also sexually.
Well, I think that it caused real dilemmas for both of them. I think many men did sincerely idealize womanhood, although for most of them, the flip side of that was a tremendous contempt for a woman who did not live up to the idealized notion of pure womanhood. If you weren't a pure woman, then you were a fallen woman. And there wasn't the old colonial and medieval kind of shrug your shoulders and move on with it. It was much more strict division. But for the kind of woman that most men wanted for a wife, you wanted they actually did, I think of them as weak, needing protection. Their whole notion of manhood began to change from their civic duty, which was the Republican ideal, to their family duty to protect their wife and their children. They idealized their wife as moral exemplars and pure sources of purity, even as they dismissed their wives' intellectual or productive capacities. And for women, I think there was this tremendous dilemma. On the one hand, they internalized this notion of themselves as the more moral sex, the more pure sex. In fact, 19th century letters and diaries, women often refer to men as the grosser sex. However, they were the sex that was going to protect them and provide for them. And so somehow you had to develop a love out of this. So there was I think many couples were able to improve their relationships by really working at the warmth and the mutual respect. But others were, I think, extremely disconcerted. For example, in the 19th century, there seems to have been a real epidemic of anxiety and among women because they could not let go with sex. They had been told that they were sexless. You know, in the medieval world, women were considered to be the lusty sex who enjoyed sex even more than men and pursued it and were more prone to sexual error. But part of this division of spheres was that women were pure, they didn't want sex. And so when they had to begin to have sex, it was very disconcerting. And in fact, there's rather interesting evidence that, for example, the vibrator was invented because women got so upset and nervous and wound up because of the fact that they were sexually repressed, that doctors used to massage them to orgasm, and the vibrator helped relieve them of that tedious job. Or they would go to the water cure. You know, you hear read about the water cure in a novel and you think, oh, you know, isn't that nice? But no, the water was set up like a jacuzzi with a spray directed to the place where it might indeed induce an orgasm. For their part, men they knew how to behave with prostitutes, but how do you behave with this woman that you're idealizing? And in fact, when the first sexual advice book for men came out in the 1920s, men wrote into the author saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. One of them said, you know, my wife once had an orgasm and I thought she was having a fit. Another one wrote and said, thank you for telling me this because I was afraid to do any foreplay with my wife for fear she would think I was treating her like a prostitute or a mistress. So there was a lot of tension between the two over these sexual matters and over what love is when it is based upon having to adore someone who has so little in common with you.
That's so interesting. And I'll bring in Oneida here a little bit. And, you know, like one of the fascinating things about Oneida was that it appears from the evidence that women there regularly orgasm during sex. And I don't know, it sounds like you maybe don't know the particulars of how they did this, how they practiced sex.
No.
It's so interesting. So, you know, they lived in this system called complex marriage. And so by its peak, there were about 200 adults, and they lived in one giant mansion that they called the Mansion House. And that's where I was last week. It's still there. You could take a tour. It's actually a bed and breakfast also. So everybody had their own little room, sort of like a college dorm room, very small and Spartan. And they were sort of discouraged from spending a lot of time there. And they had these big public spaces, this meeting hall and lots of sort of salons, and then this grand lawn when the weather was good. And they would, if someone wanted to have sex with someone else, they would have to go through an intermediary. And it was the man who usually requested, but an intermediary who was often a female would approach the woman and say, so-and-so would like to have, they called it a social interview with you. And they would have the ability to accept or reject. Although it was more complicated than that. It wasn't exactly free love because there were like great record keepers, and one of their fears was that people would develop overstrong attachments to each other in a sort of binary couple way. And so you couldn't really couple off. You could have maybe a favorite lover, but you could only see them maybe once a month. And there was like a committee that was sort of in charge of regulating this. And they controlled the sort of, there was definitely a hierarchy. They had this concept they called ascending fellowship. And the idea was that some people were more spiritually enlightened than others. And spiritually enlightened men should be mostly paired off with people in the bottom rank for women and vice versa. And they used this in a lot of ways. And some of it was, I think, just sort of the charismatic leader, John Humphrey Noyes, wanted access to the younger women. And that system allowed that because he was the most enlightened. But there was also a practical aspect too. They were very concerned about not having unwanted pregnancies. Mm-hmm. And partly for personal reasons, John Humphrey Noyes, before this community started, was married to a woman who I think had 4 miscarriages. And it was just, you know, brutal for them. And so he invented this birth control method that they called male continence. And essentially it was that men don't ejaculate. And you had to learn how to do it, though. And they were very concerned that young boys wouldn't do it. They would, you know, they would fail. And so they were sort of brought into the community by postmenopausal women. And that was part of the Ascending Fellowship. Mm-hmm. But the result was that women's sexual needs were attended to, according to the records that they kept and that I've seen. And they regularly would orgasm during sexual encounters. And interestingly, the men wouldn't. So I guess, I don't know if you have any reaction to that. I'm curious, you know, like, I assume that's extremely unusual for the 19th century, but I'm just curious what you make of that.
Well, you know, the issue of male control didn't usually take that form, but that was one of the anxieties of an era of expanding capitalism and the breakdown of traditional community controls and oversight over people, hence the tremendous fears of masturbation, I think. But this, of course, took it in quite a different way, and I can well understand how you combine that sort of more prolonged, rather than the thing, wham-bam approach to sex for women, combined with the less fear of pregnancy, would obviously make it much more easy for women to enjoy sex and orgasm. That's not surprising to me at all.
Okay, and I think you mentioned this a minute ago, but I wonder if you could expand on it a little bit. You said that in the 19th century, there was sort of a narrowing of the circle of affection to the nuclear family. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, well, in colonial and medieval times, the social controls of villages were really interdependent in ways that you could not get along without trading some of your goods to your neighbors. You often, people who made things had bespoken goods that was made for a neighbor, and somebody couldn't come in and outbid for it because it would have just destroyed the fact that you're going to be dependent on that neighbor. You know, and we're not talking about an egalitarian society, but we're talking about a highly interdependent one whose hierarchies were necessary for everybody. You know, the upper class ones provided servant work for the kids of the lower class. They provided charity, you know, not enough maybe, but some in times of drought. They depended upon the labor of their neighbors. And your social values grew up around that. The word love in the 18th century is used as often for neighbors, for God, for your duties to the community as it is for your family. And it certainly extends beyond the nuclear couple to cousins and anybody else who can be brought into this large social, personalized social support system that you need in order to make things go. It's so as that broke down, as people moved away from or didn't move away from, but began to sell their goods to an impersonal market, not to depend upon their neighbors. As the nature of work changes, and instead of you having apprentices who work in your home, take a break when you do, are under your thumb, under your authority. But on the other hand, you know, if you take a drink break, you pass them a drink break. As this moves out and there's no chance that these apprentice shoemakers will become shoe masters themselves. They work in a different place. And when they drink, they no longer drink with you. They go out and drink with each other and maybe complain about you. So there's all sorts of anxieties about this breakdown of community, and people respond in different ways. One way is to increase the emphasis on the importance of protecting your own family. But the other, in this time of idealism and lack of clarity about where this would end up, is you got a lot of these communities that were trying to figure out a new source, a voluntary source of community, no longer imposed by Puritan leaders or elites or whatever, but nevertheless reproducing the interdependence that they saw being eroded.
Well, that's so interesting. And I think it helps us understand Oneida a little bit better because, you know, when I explain this project that I'm working on in this podcast to people, they're fascinated, but they just think it's so bizarre, you know, what they tried. But I'm just thinking through now, like your description of the separate spheres and the sort of kind of the idea that love was not something that was uniquely centered in the nuclear family. And, you know, Noyes, like, it's interesting. He's, I think, both criticizing, he's sort of a critic both from the left and the right of the way family and marriage had been practiced up to that point. And so, like, you know, he's absolutely against the separate spheres doctrine, right? Women have very privileged positions of work. They edited the newspaper. They were spared from the drudgery of normal housekeeping at Oneida. They rotated their jobs constantly. They were spared from drudgery of childcare. They raised their children communally. And he certainly, you know, did not think that women had a monopoly on the moral aspect of life. We've talked already about how, you know, he was a big believer that women should have an active libido. And to the point about the centering of affection in the family, you know, they called their giant community of 300 people the family, and they referred to themselves as the Oneida community, and they lived in this place that they called the Mansion House. And so it seems like he both was, you know, not agreeing in some ways with the critics on the right who wanted this traditional society where marriage was loveless, but also shared the concerns of those critics that a sort of free-for-all of romantic love would lead to anarchy and chaos. And so he tried to control it through, he wanted those things, but wanted them to not be quite so free or, you know, destabilizing.
But it's not just destabilizing, but two close relationships where you do get someone who's a partner is destabilizing in a way that the traditional social conservatives wanted, in the sense that it creates these exclusive bonds.
The early Christian religion also saw close family ties as a threat to the loyalty to the community. If you'll recall, Jesus tells a man not to attend the funeral of his father. He says in several instances that what you really need to do is go out from your family. And as St. Paul put it, the man or woman who is married loves the spouse, thinks of the spouse first rather than God and the Christian community first. So this has been a long tradition in Christianity. And I think that in the context of what people saw as the breakdown of the social interdependence of earlier days, there was a real attempt to prevent people from forming these exclusive and exclusionary ties.
Yeah, well, so that's what was so interesting about that is they definitely saw that at Oneida, and they had a term that they used to describe couples that bonded too closely. And they called it, sometimes they called it sticky love, and sometimes they called it special love. And it could be true both for married couples, but it was interestingly also true for parents of their children. And they had a really interesting enforcement mechanism. They had this system called mutual criticism, where you would basically go in front of a panel of people who had been observing you, and they would single out things that you needed to work on and to improve at very publicly. And sticky or special love was often something that you were quite criticized for. And so Noyes was, you know, I think, you know, he was really quite sophisticated in his analysis of what was going on and his sort of scheme to try to combat it. You know, do you think that there's anything we can learn from a group like this?
Well, Well, I think it's fascinating to look at the different ways people have recognized some of the dilemmas and contradictions in all of the, you know, various family arrangements that we have tried and love arrangements we have tried. And so I think that it's interesting to see what people were trying to do, even if they didn't succeed, and trying to get to past the parts of it that we think are either crazy or unpalatable, just to understand where they're coming from and what their the kernel of legitimate criticism might be, you know. And if we do that with historical kinds of movements, it might help us be a little better able to understand things we disagree with so tremendously now. To understand them is not necessarily to forgive them or go along with them, but it's the best chance we have of beginning to look at what fears, dilemmas, contradictions people face in their lives, so that we can offer perhaps better alternatives, or at least find ways of working with those people rather than writing them off as immoral perverts.
Yeah, well, that's so interesting, and it's I think quite wise. But and I guess this will be my last question, because what's so complicated about Oneida is that I think on the one hand he was a really John Humphrey Noyes was a really farsighted, really kind of a genius at analyzing what was happening around him, and then also like really not just having a vision for a new way of doing it, but actually making it work for about 30 years, which really impressive. On the other hand, the more you learn about him personally, there's a creepy factor. You know, one of his one of the writers, Ellen Wayland Smith, she put it this way. She said that his theological edifice, she said, was an almost laughably transparent attempt to accommodate his own peculiar psychosexual needs, a structure jerry-rigged to house a fragile ego. And you could completely make that case. You know, like every time he introduced an innovation, it was usually because he wanted to sleep with a particular person.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, I sort of struggle with how to think about him. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that or any advice about how to think about people who are so complicated.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, people are a complex mix of things, you know, and you see it all over the place, and particularly when it comes to sexuality. I mean, look at all the, you know, the really, really moral people who turn out to, you know, not be their morale, their mainstream morality has developed as a way of controlling their very non-mainstream impulses, and often it's not sufficient to do so. So, I always make a distinction. You know, I don't believe in judging things on people's persons. What's interesting to me is that very often people who do these radical kinds of things do have tremendous hang-ups. What, as a historian, fascinates me is what is it in what they say, no matter what reasons they say it or do it, that speaks to needs or impulses or discontents in the people they attract to follow them, who may not have, you know, the same sort of, selfish kinds of problems that you explain Noyes had. But that, to my mind, is the question I ask as a historian and as a citizen.
Yeah.
When I see other leaders today who have repulsive personalities, but I don't want to assume that everybody who follows them has a repulsive reason for doing so.
Who could you possibly be talking about?
I don't know.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It was really interesting. I really appreciate it. And I loved your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really great.
What you're doing sounds fascinating. So please keep me in the loop.
I absolutely will. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks again.
So how did Harriet Holton respond to John Humphrey Noyes' marriage proposal?
Fortunately for him, she was more than game to go along with his unconventional program. She wrote back, saying that she understood that their union would not, quote, limit the range of our affections. I only expect to be placed in a situation where I can enjoy your society and instruction as long as the Lord pleases. And she offered her heartfelt hope that, quote, the grace of God will exclude jealousy and everything with which the marriage state is defiled. So how did they recruit more than 200 others to join them in their expansive vision of marriage? That's next time on American Utopia.